Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to this episode of Fake TV Critic, a podcast where I discuss the week's biggest TV news headlines, recap and analyze some of my favorite shows, and let you know what you should be watching. Okay, so a lot of like viral-ish news this week. First is that Disney Plus is rebooting, reimagining, redoing whatever the hell you want to call it. Daredevil for its Marvel series. And personally, I just wish people would let this character go. I do not understand why people find Daredevil so interesting, but it had, I think, 3 seasons, maybe 4 seasons on Netflix before the Disney Plus Marvel partnership happened. The original series from Netflix is now streaming on Disney Plus. And then, you know, Matt Murdock, the Daredevil character, appeared in the latest Spider-Man movie, so this isn't entirely surprising that they would maybe try to do this again. I did not enjoy the Netflix Daredevil series. I might be one of the only ones, but I just found it very boring. I think I watched maybe the first season, maybe half of the first season, and then tried to watch the second season. I don't remember, but I didn't like it. But everyone else did, apparently. So, new Daredevil series at Disney Plus is happening. Okay. Also, Saturday Night Live was renewed for a new season, and this past weekend, several main cast members made their final appearances. Some of them not so shocking, like Kate McKinnon, it was her last episode, Adi Bryant, Pete Davidson, and Kyle Mooney. And I think, like I said, at least to me, Kate McKinnon and Pete Davidson, those are very unsurprising departures for me. Kate McKinnon was barely there this season, especially the beginning of the season. In the fall, she was filming Joe versus Carol, that terrible Peacock show, which I've still never watched a second episode of. So she was not around. And then when she was around, she would be in like one sketch. It was very strange. Pete Davidson was almost never around. He was mostly in pre-recorded things. And, you know, he just got a deal for a new TV series on Peacock called Bupkis. That's, I think, loosely based on his life. And Edie Falco is going to play his mom. And, you know, he's got his burgeoning relationship with Kim Kardashian to think about. So, like, neither of those really surprised me. Adi Bryant has been, I feel like, trying to kind of break out of SNL, as everyone who's in SNL inevitably does. But it's odd timing for me, considering the thing that she had been doing that was kind of her, you know, way out, I guess, if you want to think of it that way, was Shrill on Hulu, and that's already ended. So maybe she's going to pursue some new TV projects, maybe finally do some film. I don't know. It kind of reminds me like when Vanessa Bayer, however you say her last name, left a few seasons ago. She didn't really have anything immediately lined up, but now she has her own show on Showtime, and she did some bit parts of movies. So I like Adi Bryant a lot. I think of all the people, these people that are leaving, I think to me, her absence is going to be felt the most, if only because, like I said, Kate McKinnon and Pete Davidson were kind of not all that present to, I thought. So, and then finally, Kyle Mooney, who actually, I take it back, maybe his absence will be felt the most, if only because he's in, like, I feel like every sketch. And I don't particularly like him. I don't find him all that funny. He's very much in that I look strange, so laugh at me thing. Like, and I fucking hate his Baby Yoda thing, which they just did a couple weeks ago on SNL. I hate it. So, anyway, those four had their final appearances this past week on SNL. I hope that they do not replace them, because this cast is so big. Like, honest to God, whenever I watch SNL, which is not often, and it's often not live because I'm an old lady and I need to be asleep, I the opening credits are the most painful part of any episode because they're 80 minutes long. Like, this is a 2-hour show, and an hour and 20 minutes of that, I feel like, is the opening credits because there are so many people in it. It's like that Family Guy sketch of the Maude opening where they just keep singing and singing and singing. It's except literally true. There are so many people in this cast. We don't need them. Like, honestly, I feel like we should have lost more than just the four. I don't need Melissa Villaseñor. I don't need her. There are probably a dozen others that we don't need. What's that dude, Aristotle, who is barely there? Why is he there? Punky Johnson's barely there. Why do you need her? There's just so many people in this cast, and they don't do anything. Anyway. Finally, businessy news that kind of like swept through Twitter that I saw this week is that Netflix laid off about 150 employees this week because their growth has kind of stalled over the past year or so, and especially in the last few quarters. You know, meaning like for years we've been hearing like Netflix is the future. Everyone has Netflix. If you're cutting cable, you're paying for a Netflix account. That they are the streamer. They are the number one. But then apparently in the past couple of quarters, like especially since the beginning of the pandemic, like that was when Netflix was booming, right? Because we were all stuck at home. But now that things are reopening, I don't know if it's that people are going back to work and stuff and canceling subscriptions, if people are starting to share subscriptions because the price went up, if people canceled because the price went up. I don't know what it is, or if they've just hit a wall of growth. Like at some point, this is going to happen where streaming services are just not going to be able to get new subscribers in any sort of meaningful number. Because there are people who are older who are just going to refuse to get Netflix. And then at some point, you're going to, you know, run out of people who are younger who are going to need Netflix accounts. Like, I think that's just kind of realistic, especially when you're raising your prices, that they're going to start sharing with other people. They're going to start sharing passwords and or they're going to start making decisions about which streaming content they want. And maybe they're going to go with like a Disney Plus instead, or they're going to go with a bundled package like a Disney Plus and a Hulu and a ESPN Plus, or they're going to go with the Paramount Plus with Showtime or whatever the other thing that was shoved in there was. But citing their slowing growth, Netflix laid off about 150 people this past week, which I thought was very odd because, like, yes, if you need to save money and you employ like 11,000 people, laying off 150 isn't that big of a stretch and is also a way to eliminate costs without eliminating without people feeling it on the service itself. Meaning like if they cut whatever money these 150 employees make, if they cut that from say like acquisition, or if they cut that from production or whatever, then we would see fewer programs, we'd see lower quality content, stuff like that. Laying off people on the back end is maybe going to slow some content at some point, but we're not going to like see a difference. But what I found kind of infuriating on behalf of these employees about this is that next week, the fourth season of Stranger Things releases the first 7 of its 9 episodes. The second half, quote unquote, the final 2 are coming out July 1st. So people have been waiting for this new season of Stranger Things. I think the third season aired in 2019. So 3 years, maybe even more if I'm incorrect about when that third season aired. People have been waiting forever. And I feel like this is kind of indicative of Netflix. This is a tangent again. Indicative of Netflix overall is that they're slow to release their original content. Like they'll renew things and then you'll forget that they got renewed and all of a sudden there's a new season on Netflix. You're like, oh, cool. Or they renew things and just never come back to them. I'm thinking of like Unsolved Mysteries. I'm pretty sure that got renewed years ago and we haven't gotten new episodes. Like, I don't understand. But anyway, this new season of Stranger Things, part of the reason it took so long is that each episode is basically a movie. The creators have said that the episodes are longer and that the season of 9 episodes is almost twice as long as their longest season, which I mean would make that okay. So each episode is somewhere between like 1 hour and 15 minutes and 2 hours, I guess. And that's reflected in the cost. So each episode of Stranger Things costs Netflix $30 million. Each episode, and there are 9 episodes. That's $270 million for one season of Stranger Things. $270 million. For context, I think that's more than a single Marvel movie costs. So that's wild to me that if this is the kind of money that Netflix is spending on their marquee original content, can they really not like cut money somewhere from those things? Do you know what I mean? It's weird. And okay, so that basically the gist of that story is that Netflix is no longer top dog. We're starting to see some cracks, and I'm really intrigued in a car crash kind of way to see what exactly happens with this. Because, like, we have Disney Plus touting every quarter, like, their growth and how wonderful they're doing and all that. I don't see as much of a wide market for Disney Plus as for Netflix, but maybe I'm being naive in that. So there's that. But just to like see, are we reaching a streaming breaking point where people are going to start going back to cable? Or are we just going to start eliminating the need for any type of streaming and cable service? Like, is streaming about to start going the way of cable? Are people going to start canceling it and we're going to start getting less content and the content we do get is going to be less? I don't see that happening anytime soon, but like, is that now the trajectory that we are on? I don't know. Okay, so that's all I got for news. Also, in some renewal cancellations, Apple TV Plus renewed Pachinko for season 2. Amazon renewed Upload for season 3. HBO renewed Barry, which just started for season 4, I think. And then Heartstopper on Netflix, which has been a huge viral sensation. I have not watched yet. It's obviously on my list. Got renewed for 2 more seasons at Netflix, seasons 2 and 3. And then on Hulu, they canceled MODOK, that animated Marvel show that Patton Oswalt was in. And the CW announced this upcoming season of Riverdale, the 7th, will be its last. So I'm doing a dance on that show's grave. I finally give up on it this season. It's fucking terrible. Okay, coming up this week on the podcast, it is a good gay week. I am talking about the 3rd season of Legendary and the new season of RuPaul's Drag Race All Stars, All Winners, Queen of All Queens. Stay tuned. Let's talk about Legendary. I know that I've mentioned it before. I think I might have recommended it last year, but I don't think I've ever gone like kind of in depth with it. And there's a reason for that. And the reason is that as much as I love this show, it really frustrates the hell out of me. And that was especially evident last season, season 2, that aired last summer. I started out loving the season. And then, like a lot of other viewers, most if not all viewers, based on social media, there was an elimination of House of Tishi that I didn't finish, that made me not finish the season. They were clear and away the best house, the front runners. They were always wonderful. And then I don't even remember what happened, but in one episode, they not only fell on the bottom, they were eliminated. And it made no sense. And it was stupid and it was aggravating. And in my eyes, it meant that an undeserving house won. So I stopped watching last season, but then I was very excited to see that season 3 was happening and that it was premiering so soon after it was announced by HBO Max. And I got excited all over again. And after watching the first 3 episodes, I'm still in that like love hate relationship with this show. So if you are not familiar, Legendary is a competition series on HBO Max. It's in its third season, and it follows houses in the ballroom scene, which if you're not familiar with that, ballroom is an underground queer culture that it's what Pose was, where Pose was set, of like a place where misfits, outsiders, queer people, gay people, trans people could all gather together and take elements of like the straight world, the fashion world, and put them together and perform and like live their lives basically and get their zhuzh for the course of an evening. And it was very popular and with Black and especially Black trans people in the 70s and 80s and 90s. It was the subject of the documentary Paris is Burning, which I have practically memorized. I have seen so many times. Like I said, Pose is about the ballroom culture. There was a series on some weird channel that I can't remember a few years ago called My House that was also set in the ball world. And then now we have Legendary. And this, these houses still exist. They still compete. It's a little more, it's a little less underground rather. And, but then there are all these legendary houses where like you come up through them and you are a child of the house and you perform for the house and you win trophies for the house. You become a mother of the house and then you compete and then you become legends. You become legendary. And regardless, it's this wonderful, accepting queer community, right? That's the whole basis of it. And the show Legendary takes that and turns it into a competition, which, I mean, is not that far of a stretch. A lot of, there are Vogue battles and things like that in ballroom. But what Legendary does, from my understanding, and I am not part of the ballroom culture, is that what they do is not necessarily what is done at functions or at balls. Voguing is not choreographed, it's expressive. And we hear Laomi say that a couple of times in this season, that it's not something you can plan. It's not like balls are not highly choreographed. You practice skills and that, and you make costumes, things like that, but you don't like choreograph entire dance numbers. But that is what is happening on Legendary. So it's a drag race style of like, we're going to make this thing that's kind of ugly and the beauty of its, the beauty of it comes from its ugliness in a lot of cases. Right. And we're going to make it glossy and glittery and shiny for a mass audience. And there's not necessarily anything wrong with that. I mean, look at what Drag Race has done for drag in general. And at least with Legendary, it is, there are queer people on the judging panel and there's a queer person hosting and the houses are still queer people. So that's all great. And it's still holding true to its roots in a lot of ways, but it's just, it's not necessarily like what you see on the show is not necessarily what you would see if you went to a function. So that's one thing. And maybe because of that is where a lot of my issues with the judging of the show comes from. So like, if what is being judged is not necessarily what ballroom actually is or what you would see at a ball, then I don't understand the judges' standards. And I don't understand them in general either. Like, of all the competition shows that I watch, this one to me seems to be the most subjective when it comes to the judging. Like, I'll just use episode 3, for example, of this season. Anita, the Brazilian singer, is the guest judge, and she has no idea what ballroom is. None. And she just is getting her life on this judging panel. She loves everyone. She's so excited to be there. She's like bouncing in her seat and gushing over all the houses. And she gives out a bunch of 10s to groups that other judges are like, you know, that was okay. I'll give you a 6. Right? Like, that's not normal. I mean, she does give And that's not true. She gave a 9 to a house that other people, that the other judges gave 6s and 7s to. But then she gives 10s to groups that others are giving 9s to and 8s to. And I think she gave one low grade and it was a 7. Like, that was her lowest grade. But she was just having fun. And that's fine and wonderful. But, like, I feel like she in a lot of ways stands in for the audience. Because to me, I'm watching this and I'm like, I don't know how they're judging this. Everyone is just so good. I mean, for the most part, there are obviously some weak points. But, like, I don't know what the judges are judging on. And I don't know if they do sometimes either. Because there will be things like, I don't know, I loved it. It was great. I want you to come back and do the same thing. I give you a 7. Like, okay, well, then why is it only a 7? You know what I mean? Or, like, or you messed up this one element, so I'm giving you a 7. And then the next house, well, you messed up that same element, but I liked you better, so I'm giving you a 9. Like, it's just, it's so strange. And again, that's what ballroom is. It's like, you like a house, you like a person, you like a performance, whatever. So you give a higher score. It's very dependent on your mood. And that's okay. But then to try to make that into something objective, like a scoring competition, doesn't really make any sense. You know, like, if you're there to showcase in the first couple episodes the 5 elements of Vogue, duck walk, catwalk, hands, floor, spins, and dips. If those are your criteria and houses are missing them, like, maybe you need to come up with a point system in your head of like, okay, well, you're supposed to give us 5 things, but you didn't give us one of them, so I'm taking 2 points off. Maybe that's what you need to be. I don't know. Like, that's what I have to do when I'm grading papers, right? There's nothing really, it's subjective grading people's writing, but then I'll have to look at it and be like, okay, well, you had this many errors of this type, so I'm going to take off this many points. Or, like, these are the things I'm looking for. I'm looking for a thesis, support, citation format, and, you know, last but not, and like punctuation or something, like whatever the main topic, like a transition word or a punctuation we've worked on that week, like comma splices or something. And if you, like, are missing one of those elements or one is weak, that's how I'm going to grade your paper. So that it's not just like, well, I don't like you, so I'm going to grade you down. But that's kind of what ballroom is and what the show ends up being sometimes. So it's frustrating to see, like, in episode 2, they split the premiere into 2 episodes, 5 houses in each to introduce themselves. And in episode 2, one of the houses that landed in the bottom was House of Ada, who I really enjoyed. I thought they were great. But then the critiques from the judges were, it's too choreographed. Vogue is supposed to be emotional. And it's supposed to be, you know, like, it's not supposed to look like a dance. And I understand that, but, like, the whole point of the show is to make it look highly choreographed. Like, they literally work with a choreographer. So that doesn't make any sense to me. And it doesn't make any sense to the other judges. Like, again, last season, season 2, not a great season, to be honest. The judges fought constantly. Like, Law Roach, I can't stand that bitch. He was such a douchebag on the panel and, like, would fight with the other judges constantly. But then now this season, they seem to be, like, kind of bowing to Laomi a lot more, since she is the judge from the ballroom scene, that they're kind of, like, taking her perspective more as gospel than the other judges, which, again, I think is appropriate. She's the one who's been there. Like, Jamila Jamil, what the fuck are you doing there? Like, who even are you? Why are you judging this competition? Like, do you need to take her comments all that seriously? No. And that's what some houses said in past seasons. So, also this season, Megan Thee Stallion was replaced by Kiki Palmer, who I think is a great choice. I love her and she's so infectious. But, like, again, a lot of the critiques will be things like, I needed more energy, or I needed to be cleaner. I'm like, to me, I don't know how you give more energy than a lot of these houses do. And when they say give more energy, I'm like, what do you want them to do? Like, literally, what do you expect? Because I don't understand. We need to be cleaner. And now, like I've said, I've seen Paris is Burning dozens of times. And just because you are cleanly voguing does not always mean you're going to win that Vogue battle. It's also about attitude and sexuality and performance. And that doesn't always mean having clean lines. You know, like, there's a reason that some of the most popular dance forms in America are also not the most classic. Like, there's a reason that, you know, America's Best Dance Crew and stuff, and So You Think You Can Dance, there's a reason that they don't do ballet, is because we're looking for America's favorite dancers. And ballet can be boring. because it's perfection. Like, we expect perfection. When you see perfection, it gets boring. So I don't think that you need to always have clean lines to be good at voguing or to win a Vogue battle or to make your house stand out. It's strange. But it is also wildly, wildly entertaining. And to see this many queer people on one show living their best queer lives, and like, especially to see so many trans women of color. And in this particular season, Aja from season 9 of Drag Race and All Stars 3 is on the cast since her transition. She came out in 2021 as a trans woman, and she is part of the House of LaBeija. Again, back to Paris is Burning, a legendary house. Started with Crystal LaBeija from The Queen, which is streaming on Netflix, or at least it used to be. And then in Paris is Burning, Pepper LaBeija, Pepper LaBeija. They are now being represented on Legendary and showing that these houses continue with new people in them. And now it's under Aja's tutelage. And just the, like, expanding into like all male houses, which are both sometimes interesting and sometimes like cringy. Like, cause there was an all cis female house last season, which again, another thing I did not like about season 2 of Legendary. And then we have a Pacific Northwest ballroom group, House of Ada again. So to see these like different houses start to be exposed, but to give them exposure is very interesting and fun to watch. But then also it makes Dota super critical because like they're expecting, I don't know if it's like, if they're expecting whatever, a level of performance that they're not giving, if they're expecting too much, if the editing is covering up mistakes, or again, if it's all just so subjective that I don't know, because Anita as a judge made me really question everything on the show because she loved almost everyone. And that's kind of how I feel. Like there are a couple houses where I'm like, I didn't like that. But for the most part, I'm like, that was fun. That was so much fun. So then to see negative critiques, it kind of either confuses me, especially when the critique is more energy and I just watch them like throw themselves around the stage for 60 seconds. Maybe it's me. Maybe it's the show. Maybe it's just the concept in general. Like, we're not supposed to agree. Like, we should just be along for the ride, which I'm okay with sometimes too. But it's so fucking gay. It's so queer and so over the top and so fun, and also very touching to hear these people whose stories are very much like, this is my chosen family because I don't have a real one anymore. Things like that. It's very affirming. And like you'll hear in my recap of Drag Race All Stars, that like, it's just so gratifying to see queer people tell queer stories and to celebrate queerness, and for there to be so much queerness right now, because honestly, I don't know how much longer this mainstream acceptance of queerness is going to go. To get political for a minute, with Roe v. Wade potentially being overturned very soon, LGBTQ plus rights are next. I think a lot of us have kind of thought of gay marriage is legal now, so LGBTQ people have no more issues. And that's just not true. Trans people are under attack constantly and currently. It was just made a felony in Alabama to give gender-affirming care to trans people. Similar bills are on the docket in Texas and I believe Oklahoma and Arkansas, I think. Trans teenagers are being banned from participating in high school sports with the gender that they identify with. It's really, trans bathroom bills still exist in a lot of states, or are still on the docket in a lot of states. It's scary out there. And to see a celebration of especially transness on a show like this is really something that, even when I don't agree with the judging or understand the judging or like the judges, is very affirming, I already said, but is kind of heartwarming in a way, and is important. It's important. So if you haven't ever watched Legendary, I highly recommend especially season 1, and you don't have to start from the beginning. You can start from season 3. Because even the judges acknowledge season two was a joke. Like, there's a new twist this season where if a judge thinks that a house has been unfairly judged, they can pull out their gag flag and save them from being in the bottom that week. And one's already been used. And, like, literally when they introduced us in episode one, Jamila outright said it's because of House of Tishy last season. So, like, it didn't just rub me the wrong way. It also pissed off the judges. And I think they got a lot of shit from fans and maybe even from the network after the fact about that elimination. So it's fun. It's fun. It can be frustrating, but that's life. And that's ballroom apparently too. So if you liked Pose, if you have seen Paris is Burning and enjoyed it, if you like Drag Race, you will like Legendary. So give it a shot. 3 seasons streaming now on HBO Max. 3 episodes of season 3 have released already. And then there are 3 more episodes coming this week and next week, and then the finale airs the week after. So a 4-week release pattern, so we don't have to wait very long to see who comes out on top. I am just in gay heaven on gay cloud 9, skipping down the gay street all this past weekend, because we have RuPaul's Drag Race All-Stars Season 7, all winners, Queen of All Queens! Also, Season 3 of Legendary. And also, I live in New Hope, Pennsylvania, and it is Pride this weekend. So we are having the parade and the festival, and, like, even though it's run by corporate assholes who don't care about us and that's problematic, I am doing the good work and marching. Anyway, that's not the point. The point is, this is the epitome of gay TV nirvana. It is everything. When I don't know if casual fans of Drag Race, which some of you may be diehards like I and so many others are, but for casual fans of Drag Race or of reality TV shows kind of in general, I don't know if you will understand how, I want to say, like, liberating, how exciting, how deeply satisfying it is to get an all-winners season of anything, of any reality competition series, but especially of RuPaul's Drag Race. It's something that fans have been begging for years, especially now with so many international and including English-speaking international iterations of Drag Race. There are so many all-star seasons that there's such a wide berth of talent to pull from, and so many of them have such close ties to the production company, to RuPaul, to the show, to the conventions, to all of it, that it would just be so wonderful to see the best of the best come back. And the issue has always been, as Bob the Drag Queen and even Jinx Monsoon, who is on the show, has said in the past, one is the cash prize, that if you are going to have an all-winner season, if you want winners to come back, you have to up the ante. You can't be doing this $100,000 prize. It needs to be more. Bob suggested $1 million, and I don't think that is a bad suggestion. This show makes so much fucking money for CBS Viacom, for Paramount Plus, for World of Wonder, for RuPaul, that there's no reason they can't get them $1 million. Now, they didn't do that, but they did up it to $200,000, which is something. You also have to change the format. And this is something, again, that I believe it's Bob has argued in favor of, that, like, if you are going to have an all-winner season, no winner of the show wants to come back to All Stars and be the first one voted out. No winner wants to be put in that position to be like, well, clearly because I got voted out first, I'm the worst of the best. No one wants to be in that position. So there needs to be a change. And I think Bob and some others, Alaska and Jinx and fans, have suggested points systems where, like, maybe you get, like, 3 points for a win, 2 points for a top placement, 1 point for safe, 0 points for a bottom, something like that. And they kind of have done that as well. Not the point system, but they've changed the format. So All-Star Season 7, all winners, Queen of All Queens, premiered this past Friday with 2 episodes on Paramount Plus. And first of all, the first episode was a full 90 minutes. Full 90 minutes, like 90 minutes of show, not 90 minutes, including commercials, which equals out to like a little, like maybe 64 minutes of show. No, 90 minutes of show. Thank you, gay gods. And we got to like be reintroduced to a lot of these queens. And it's just, it was such a breath of fresh air. I'm getting ahead of myself. But anyway, the format of the show, there are 8 returning winners. And in every episode, there will be a top 2. And those top 2 get pins, kind of like on the international seasons. And the pins are legend star points. So every time you are in the top 2, you get a pin and a point. And then the points are going to determine who competes at the very end of the show for the grand prize in a lip sync Lollapalooza, because they love a fucking lip sync. And then that winner gets $200,000. So you need to accrue points to make it to the top 4 in the finale. And then you also, the top 2, will lip sync for a $10,000 cash tip, and also for the opportunity to use the Platinum Plunger, which is so fucking absurd and stupid. But you get to block another queen who is not in the top 2 from getting points next week. So there's also strategy to this, but no one goes home. Until the finale, everyone who is on the show is on the show. And like, that is so nice. And I don't think that I would like this format with a regular All-Star season, because there are always people on All-Star season who I don't think belong on quote-unquote All-Stars. You know, like, I don't need to see Serena Cha-Cha in every episode. You know what I'm saying? I just don't. I don't need to see Pheromone in every episode, even though I love Pheromone outside the show. I don't need to see her in every episode. You see what I'm saying? So I don't think I need this format to continue on. I don't think that I need 15 queens every... I mean, like, look how exhausting it got on this past season of Drag Race, of season 14, where, like, there were, a stretch of, like, 4 episodes where no one went home, and I was like, I'm done with this. But for an all-winner season where we are getting the creme de la creme, or the cream de la creme, as Jada Essence Hall says in this episode, where we are getting some of the best in the literal history of this franchise, it is nice to see what everyone does. It's nice to see everyone at the top of their game. And it's really nice to see the judges being positive. Because in any season of Drag Race, there are obviously going to be people who aren't doing as well, but you don't need to amplify the negativity. And I mean, in a regular season, you kind of do, because someone needs to go home and you need to telegraph to the audience why. But like in an all-winner season, if no one's going home, you don't need to nitpick and be mean. So that's also very nice. It's such a positive season. These first 2 episodes were so positive. And like, I'm not that positive, so I'm going to talk about who I thought sucked. But in the grand scheme of the show, to like not ding anyone, to not like try to bring anyone down. I mean, like, look at the way Jan was treated on both of her seasons, where like it was a systematic approach to there are certain queens, Jan is one of them, that they are like systematic approaches to breaking them down because you want a reaction out of them. And they got it with Jan in season 12. They got the face crack, right? To not see that is, again, it's just so refreshing. The change of format is refreshing. The level of drag and talent is so refreshing. I talked last week when I recommended Drag Race España that I love it because it's campy and like you can see the talent on stage. And that's not always the case with US or even UK and Down Under drag. No, Down Under, let's not go there. UK and Canada and US drag. That a lot of times, like a lot of queens that are on the show, especially now, are look queens. They're social media queens. They're Instagram queens. Where like they're not used to performing. So when you ask them to perform, they can't do it. That is not what is happening on this season of All Star 7 All Winners, Queen of All Queens. I'm gonna do it every time. I'm sorry, I don't care. It is fun. That all of these queens are not only talented, are not only winners, are not only have money, have access, have connections, they are all doing everything. They're not just one thing. And it made for such a wonderful first 2 episodes. The first episode, we get kind of the classic now, like remix a RuPaul song, and they each get a verse. And not a week That's not true. I was going to say not a weak verse. There was, I think, 1 weak verse, but that is just my opinion. But just the quality overall of the singing of those who sang, of the rapping even of those who rapped, is just, it's so strong. And then episode 2 was fucking Snatch Game, and they made them do 2 characters. It was a double length Snatch Game, because you can do that when you have all winners. Like, looking at this cast, people who have won Snatch Game that are in the cast, you have Jinx Monsoon, who to this day has one of the most iconic Snatch Games of all time with Little Edie, and just added on to that by having the most iconic Snatch Game in the history of this show. No one will ever touch this. I'm sorry, unless Jinx comes back, no one will ever touch this. Previously, I would have said probably Alaska's Mae West was the best Snatch Game of all time, followed maybe by Ben De La Creme's Maggie Smith and Jinx's Little Edie. Jinx blew herself out of the water with her Judy Garland Snatch Game. It was flawless. It was high drag. It was one of the most entertaining things I have ever seen on reality TV, and I am not exaggerating. It was the single best performance that has ever been done on this show since season 1. I said it. So she won. Jinx won on her season. Shea Coulee won on All Stars 5. Trinity won on All Stars 4. I feel like the Vivian won on UK, and Michelle called the Vivian's Donald Trump the best Snatch Game that she'd ever seen up to that point, including on the US seasons. There are some heavy hitters doing this, so they can make them do 2 Snatch Game characters, and it doesn't feel absurd or bloated. They're just so fucking good at what they do. And to see the transformations, like, I honestly, someone in the second episode said that, like, Snatch Game is the perfect drag challenge because it combines impersonation, makeup transformation, comedy, and it's all of these things that drag queens need to be good at, that performers need to be good at. And I never thought of the makeup transformation part of it, really, maybe because so many of the queens don't really try super hard to look in the face like the people that they're trying to portray. But then thinking back, it's like, I mean, because one of my favorite Snatch Games was Bob the Drag Queen as Carol Channing. And obviously Bob looked nothing like Carol Channing. Do you know what I'm saying? But anyway, seeing those transformations and, like, having that in the back of my head before going into, like, there were people in this episode of Snatch Game that I did not recognize. Like, the transformation was so complete and so over the top and so thorough that I had no, like, Raja, both of her characters were hysterical and unexpected and stupid as all hell. And she wore prosthetics for both of them and completely transformed everything about her posture, her fate, fucking amazing. Jinx looking so much like Judy Garland. It was eerie, even though they don't have the same facial structure, but just making her face a blank canvas, it's fucking phenomenal. The Vivian wore a prosthetic as Catherine Tate from something in the UK, I don't know what. And Trinity, in her first character, played Satan and just looked nothing like Trinity and just was a character. It was fucking wild and so good. And it's just like, to watch the show and see this level of talent is fucking everything. Like, there is so little to complain about in this. And that is so nice. Cause, like, even when I love Queens, even when I love the show, like I just said, there were times in season 14 of Drag Race when I was just over it. I was like, I don't care anymore. Send people home. And to feel like I never want this show to end in this iteration with these queens is, oh God, it's made me fall in love with the show after 2 episodes, fall in love with the show all over again. If you're a new-ish viewer and you're not familiar with some of the older queens, or if you think like I did, like I wanted Jada of the tops of her season to win, but she was not my pick to win season 12. She was maybe my third choice. Like, I would have put Jan and probably Widow above her.
or even not Widow, Heidi above her. Although I liked Widow, don't get me wrong, whatever. But like of the top three, I wanted her to win. But like she won, as someone says in the reading challenge, like on a Zoom call, you know, that like it was her win was so muted because the reunion was held literally over Zoom and she won in her living room dancing on a carpet. You know, like she has something to prove, and but then also just seems so at home with these queens and seems so relaxed. Cause like that's what's so great about this, right? Okay, so the queens all seem so relaxed, all of them. And like in the first episode, they're choreographing and they have all like there's no shit talking. They don't really have anything to prove. They all already won. They're here to showcase what they can do. They're here to show people why they won. They're here to be like, what the fuck are you going to do? Take away the $100,000 that I already spent on my winning? What are you going to do? Change the Wikipedia page and say I didn't deserve it? What are you going to do? I already won. So they're here like for fun, basically. And it's so wonderful to see queens like, not really in their heads so much and just doing what they want to do and just, again, having a good time and just showing off their high level of drag, their wonderful outfits, their talents. It's so great. And like maybe of all of them, Jada has something to prove, but then she still is so comfortable in this setting and just blends right in. And it's just, oh God, I love it. So if you're a person who maybe is unfamiliar with like a Raja or a Jinx, or maybe forgot how great they were, this is going to make you fall in love with them again. If you're someone like me who thought that maybe that like Jada's win was kind of like, okay. This will make you fall in love with Jada. It's the only issue that I really have is that over the first two episodes, it seems pretty obvious to me that there is one weak link or there is one person who is the weakest link. And it's not because she's not weak, she's not bad, she's not like doing poorly, but just like the runways aren't at the same level maybe, and her because she just has a different style of drag, you know. Is Evie Oddly, that in the first episode she had on a terrible wig, which they commented on. Her verse was, I did not think, good, and it might have been the mixing too, because I couldn't hear a lot of what she was saying over the backtrack, which sometimes happens on the show and it's fucked up. Like, I don't know why they do that to these queens. I don't know if they just got like a bad feed and then they couldn't mix it correctly. I don't understand how sound works, but regardless. She had a not great look in the girl group number. She had a not great verse in the girl group number. And I think she was for sure the least impactful in the Snatch Game. She did a character, a person I've never heard of, who is a TikTok person. I don't even know her name. I still, Rico Riley, something like that. And just, it was very one note. It was nothing. It was a nothing burger. And then she did the Boogeyman as like a character she made up as like Boogie instead of B-O-G-E-Y, B-O-O-G-I-E, like making like a soul, like a Jimi Hendrix with some X's for eyes. And like, that was fun. But again, it was very one note. Like it was just sexual. So I think that as of right now, Evie is the kind of one that you're looking at like, oh, okay, I kind of wish that maybe they would have invited somebody else who would have maybe done better. But I don't know who that would be. And again, I expect Evie at some point to excel. You know what I mean? Because her drag, it was never like she's the prettiest one. She's the most put together one. It was always that she was the most creative. She was a club kid. She was fun to watch. So like, I can see there being like maybe a dance challenge or something that she'll eat the fuck up, or a talent show where she'll do something weird and, you know, and be maybe on top. But then again, you have like Jinx Monsoon there. So I don't know, but it's, other than that, so much fun to watch. And even that is, it's not that it's not fun to watch Evie, but like, it just seems, Of any negatives that they're giving on the runway, she's gotten negatives in both of the first two episodes. So it's kind of like, and I'm so excited to see where this goes, because like Monet described it as Drag Race Survivor, which I think is wonderful, where like there's so much, I think, more strategy that goes into this kind of format where you're blocking queens from scoring points. Like in the first episode, spoilers, sorry, skip ahead 30 seconds to a minute if you don't want to hear spoilers because you still want to watch it. Shay wins the lip sync in episode one and blocks Trinity from getting stars next week. And then in the Snatch Game, Trinity ends up being in the top two. So whereas she would have gotten a star, she still has zero. She still gets to lip sync and potentially win the $10,000, which she did not, Jinx did. But that kind of strategy where it's like, you don't know what's coming next. So you're like making a best guess at who you think is going to do well overall. Or maybe like Jinx was saying in episode two, if she won, she was going to block someone who won episode one. That one of those two people who already had a star, she was going to block one of them because you want to slow down people's progress. But then if Jinx does that and she wins, then that means that she has a star, then she could be a target the next week. So like, do you block people who are doing well? Do you block, like, do you try to parse out in your head, okay, well, we've done the girl group, we've done the Snatch Game. What's coming next? Is it a ball? Is it a dance challenge? Is it an acting challenge? So if you're trying to guess like, okay, well, if it's an acting challenge, maybe I want to block Jinx, right? If it's a sewing challenge, maybe I want to block Shay or Raja, right? If it's a ball, maybe you want to block Raja. Or if it's, then some of them crosses over too. Like Shay is also great at acting and sewing. Raja is great at acting and sewing. Evie is great at dancing and maybe would have some really unique looks for a ball. So like there's strategy that goes into it and you're also painting a target on your own back at the same time. So it's just interesting to watch and see how it's going to play out. I'm so excited. This season is already so good. If they do one of these like every few years, it gives me a reason to live. Honestly, it just does, you know? Like, if there is a season two of All Winners where we get like Alaska and Bob the drag queen, maybe Bianca Del Rio, who has said she won't come back for something like this, will see this, see the new format, see them having fun, see them not being critiqued, and want to come back. Maybe we'll get a Bianca. Maybe we'll get I would love to see like a Lawrence Chaney on one of these seasons. I would love to see Priyanka from Canada on this. I would love to see Blue from UK versus the world. I would love to see these queen. I would love then for them to be like, okay, maybe we can bring back BB. You know, I would love to see more of this. And the more winners we have, the bigger pool we have to draw from. And like, maybe they could even really fuck shit up and bring back whoever wins this season. You know, I'm just, it's so fun. The first two episodes are streaming right now on Paramount Plus. And I'm telling you, if you do not like, this is some shit that's worth paying for. Okay. I think Paramount Plus is $5 a month with commercials. And like, there are commercials. There aren't that many. It's not that bad. The longest commercial break, I think, is usually 2 minutes. And like, just go to the bathroom or refill your coffee or go on Instagram or whatever. Like, it's not that big of a deal. It's not like the VH1 episodes where you're watching an hour of show and a half an hour of commercials. This is the shit that's worth paying Paramount Plus for if you don't already have Paramount Plus. But the first two episodes are streaming right now, and a new episode drops every Friday through the end of July when we get the lip sync Lollapalooza for the ultimate queen of all queens crown. Oh, I can't wait. I can't wait. And please watch it so that if I see you and when I see you in person, we can talk about it.
Coming up this week, again, we are entering the doldrums, the summertime. So the shows that are coming out are a little, and a lot of the stuff that you may be watching is ending for the season. On Monday, we're getting a reboot of Don't Forget the Lyrics, hosted by Niecy Nash, and the return of Beat Shazam. On Tuesday, Paramount Plus is bringing back Yo MTV Raps, and Hulu is releasing a new documentary series called Keeper of the Ashes about the Girl Scout murders in Oklahoma in the 70s, I think it was. On Wednesday, Netflix is releasing a new season of Somebody Feed Phil and MasterChef Returns to Fox. On Thursday, HBO Max has the season 2 premiere of That Damn Michael Che. Friday, the long-awaited premiere of Obi-Wan Kenobi on Disney Plus with 2 episodes. It'll then air an episode a week on Wednesday, starting next week. And also, as I mentioned in the introduction, the return of Stranger Things Season 4. We're getting the first 7 of 9 episodes. For finales, we have this week All-American, Better Call Saul, NCIS, NCIS Hawaii and the Neighborhood, and Bob Hart's Abishola. All 3 FBI shows on CBS Tuesdays, Young Rock, the series finale of This Is Us, which, god damn, I watched the penultimate episode, and it was gorgeous. It's so good, guys. You need to be watching. This is the finale of New Amsterdam. The Circle ends its season on Netflix. All the Chicago shows end on NBC. The Courtship, which was on NBC for a while and bombed, and then bombed on USA and is now airing at like 11:30 at night. The Flight Attendant, Bull has its series finale. Bosch, Legacy, The Blacklist, 61st Street, Worst Cooks in America, 90s Edition, and Drag Race España are all ending this week. Okay, my recommendation for the week. So I was very sad this week because I found out that an author that I have been reading for 15 or so years now and who has been writing books for over 40, his real name is Richard Lopez and his pen name is Richard Stevenson. He began writing a series of gay detective novels in the 80s, centered around the character Donald Strachey. And there are 16 books in the series with a 17th coming this year. And they all deal with issues in the gay community. Things like outing and political machinations against queer people. What else? One of them was about blackmailing and using outing for that. Conversion therapy was a topic in one of them. The legalization of gay marriage was one of them. And they're really entertaining. They're not always great mysteries, but they're always very entertaining. And he was such a wonderful writer, and he wrote the best dialogue. And I loved reading his books. And for years, I'd been hearing that he was starting a new series. And just randomly this past week, I decided to Google him to find out if that new series was going anywhere, since it'd been like a year and a half, maybe, since I'd last checked and hadn't seen anything. So I Googled it and found out that in March, he had passed away at the age of 83. And I was very sad, one, because I think of him as like a very influential, very big writer in my world, at least. His writing was one of the reasons that I started writing gay fiction about 10 years ago, because one of his publishers I submitted to. And I started thinking, oh, I could do this by finding a submission form on his publisher's website. So he was almost directly the reason that I started writing gay fiction in about 2011, I think was when I first wrote, and 2012 was my first publication, regardless. And I really loved his books. I loved the Strachey series. They were always so sporadic and kind of came out so very in like a very strange release pattern, because, you know, he's older and writes pretty much for fun. But I was sad because I had considered him such an influential writer in this community. And I hadn't heard, almost 2 months he had been dead, and I had not heard anything about his passing. And that was very sad to me. So I had my emo moment this past week. And the new series did come out. He did not get to see the publication of the book, the first book and only book in the series, but he did finish it, and he died in March. It came out in April, and he did finish a final Strachey novel, which I don't think was intended to be the final Strachey novel, but is going to end up being it, that is coming out in the fall. And my recommendation for the week is going to be a series of TV movies that was based on those books, which is how I discovered them. So they've been published throughout the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. You know, like I said, 16 books over about 41 years, I think it was. And not all of them are great. I can fully admit that, but I, on some level, love all of them. And the reason I found them was because I was in high school and got a free subscription for a week to Hear TV, which was a gay network that made and produced and aired LGBT content, mostly gay and lesbian content. And they made a movie based on one of the Strachey books, not the first one, called Third Man Out. And it starred Chad Allen from Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman, who had recently come out of the closet himself as an actor. And I watched the first movie and loved it. And then I got the second on DVD from Netflix. Once I started with that like DVD in the mail subscription, because the free trial had ended. And then they released two more movies in the next couple of years. And I went to a big screen showing of one of them in Philadelphia as press for Out in Jersey magazine. And I loved that one. And then the final one was released the next year. And so there are four total. Like I said, there are 16 books, but four movies. And even though Richard Stevenson, the author, did not love these adaptations, he didn't think they did a great job of bringing his work to life, I thoroughly enjoyed them as their own thing. I did not always love them as adaptations of the books either, which is okay, but I did love them as their own, as their own series of movies. So if you have Hear TV, which I don't expect you to, I think six people in the entire country get Hear TV. All four are available to watch. The movies are Third Man Out, Shock to the System, On the Other Hand, Deaf, and Ice Blues. All four are available on Hear TV. You can also find them like randomly across the internet. Ice Blues, which is both the best and worst of the series, I think. Best because as a movie, it stands best on its own. Worst because it has almost nothing to do with the book that it's based on. And the book is not me in particular, but for most fans of the book series, is one of their favorites. And I believe was one of Richard Stevenson's favorites in the series as well. Ice Blues you can find on Amazon Prime Video for free. You can also find it on Tubi for free. And it is on, all of them are on YouTube somewhere. Ice Blues and Shock to the System are on Movies Plus, which are free on YouTube. You can just Google the titles. On the Other Hand, Death and Ice Blues Strachey, I think is what you have to YouTube search on YouTube to find them. They're on Movies Plus. The full movies are there. Third Man Out and Shock to the System are also on YouTube, but they're on the official Hear TV YouTube. And again, you can find those by Googling Third Man Out or Shock to the System Strachey, because there, I think, is a David Bowie song called Shock to the System. So make sure you add the Strachey to that if you want to look for them. I will also link them in the show notes if you are interested. Like I said, I find them all very entertaining. And with Pride season coming up, watching some queer shit that's done by some queer people is great. They're all directed by Ron Oliver, who is now, post the Strachey movies, a very prolific Hallmark Christmas movie director. He did, what was the, Christmas Everlasting, which was the Hallmark Hall of Fame movie a couple seasons ago. He has done some Candace Cameron Bure, which we won't hold against him, Christmas movies. He did, I think, The Christmas Train, which was also a Hallmark Hall of Fame movie. And he's the one who does anything that has the character of Kenny. So if you are a Deck the Hallmark listener, you will know that they have the Kennyverse theory, which like Kenny Kwan is a character that shows up in a bunch of Ron Oliver Hallmark Christmas movies. That character originated in the Donald Strachey movies. Little known fact. And he's this great actor that just kind of like comes along for the ride in all of Ron Oliver's movies and plays the same character, even though they're not connected. I believe Ron Oliver's movie this past year was Coyote Creek Christmas, maybe? Don't quote me on that. But he also directed episodes of Are You Afraid of the Dark back in the 90s and all these. He's just, he's wonderful. He's gay himself. And I love him. And I love his sensibility. And the way he directed this four Strachey movies is very much like as if they're noir mysteries of the 40s. And I love that touch. And he just brought a whimsy to all of the movies that I don't think was present in the books. The dialogue in the scripts is not great. Like I said, Richard Stevenson wrote great dialogue. The screenwriter, not so much. But that's okay. The direction is great. The acting is great. I love Chad Allen. He is not the Strachey that I ever would have pictured. But as the Strachey of the movie series, I really like him. Sebastian Spence plays his partner, Timmy, and he's just the cutest little damn thing. And then they had like some great cameos throughout as well. Like, I forget his name, but the actor who played Uncle Vic on Queer as Folk is in Third Man Out. And Margot Kidder, who is a lesbian and was in the Superman movies, is in On the Other Hand, Death. So they're just great. I highly recommend them. They're so fun to like watch on a Saturday afternoon, especially like this past weekend was brutally hot around here. So if you're not leaving your house, like curl up on the couch, put one of these on, turn the lights off, and just lose yourself in like a fun, cozy mystery with some gay themes. We don't get enough of that on TV. Or a lot of books that you can like find kind of obscurely on the internet. Like the publisher who's redoing the Strachey novels currently, called Requeered, is dedicating themselves to reprinting a lot of these gay cozy mysteries and gay mysteries from yesteryear in general. But like mainstream gay mysteries, we don't find a lot of them. And I always tend to love them when I do find them. But you can go digging for them. And it's always nice to experience these things and to kind of see where we were. Like, if you look at the topics of these books, they're old, right? Like, they're 30, 40 years old. But then some of the issues they're dealing with are still shit we're dealing with now. Like, actors being closeted and not wanting to come out because it'll ruin their careers. So they threaten gay publications who want to publish information. Kevin Spacey, allegedly. No, he finally came out. Fucking finally, douchebag. But like, yeah, conversion therapy still happening. All that shit. It's wild. So yeah, those four movies are all over the internet. Just to recap, Ice Blue's on Prime Video and on Tubi and on YouTube. The other three, Third Man Out, Shock to the System, and On the Other Hand, Death, are all on YouTube. All four are on Here TV. You can do a trial if you would like. They're also all on DVD if you're that kind of person. And yeah, have fun. Please watch them. And rest in peace, Richard Stevenson. I'm still very sad about it. Okay. Thank you for tuning into this episode of Fake TV Critic. It was a little long. Thank you for bearing with. I will be back next week with more recasts, more reviews, more analyses, and more recommendations. Have a good weekend, everyone.